This is my first time to host a speaker, and it's a real honor. In a few short conversations with Linda, I've heard some traits that I really respect. These are things that I lost before I came to Al-Anon and have found a measure of in this program. I've heard from Linda humility. She didn't claim to be a good Al-Anon. She says she tries to be a good Al-Anon. I heard a sense of humor. She laughs very easily, and that's great to hear. And I've also heard that I've seen her that she goes with the flow. She's had some plans this week change on a dime, and she has been able to go with the flow and accept life as it came, life on life's terms. So with that, I ask you to give a warm music city roundup to Linda S. from Waycross, Georgia.
I am Linda Smith, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. It's good to be here. First, I want to thank Larry and Mindy and the committee for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here and to see them again. I met them in Gulf Shores, Alabama. Also, Kay has been a perfect hostess. We've had a good time. It's been great getting to know her. But I do appreciate it. It's quite an honor and a privilege to be here with you, and I do appreciate the invitation. I'll feel a lot better when I get down from here, and I'm going to enjoy the rest of this thing. I've enjoyed myself so far, but I get really nervous. Anyway, when I always introduce myself, I say I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon, and I am, but there's been times in my life that I was not grateful for a lot of things. But today I can say that I am. I'm very grateful, even though life's not exactly like Linda wants it, and you probably never has been exactly like I wanted it. I have truly learned to be grateful for what I have and where I am at present time. And for that, I'm so grateful to God. I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a family with a mother, father, three sisters, and a grandmother. We went to church every Sunday. We were just what I'd call a normal family, kind of a middle-class family. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. One of the things I always wanted was to be like those people that had all the money and all the prestige, and I always tried to be something I wasn't, and always wanted to be somebody I wasn't. I went to high school, and in high school, I was not in the in crowd, but I found a friend that was, and I got into the in crowd. I was a cheerleader, and so I tried to be something. Now, inside, I didn't feel like I fit in. Inside, I always felt less than, but you'd never know it on the outside, because I could always put on that face, I could always put on that front. When I was a little girl, playing with my sisters or my friends, if they didn't play the way I wanted to play, I just wouldn't play with them. You see, I didn't know it, but way back then, I had a problem with control, and I'd never met an alcoholic. But it had to be my way or no way. If you didn't do it my way, then I just wouldn't do it. So that's how I kind of grew up, and I was taught, like I said, we went to church, and I was taught all those years to pray, and to pray, "Thy will be done." And I prayed that way, but today I know I didn't mean that. What I meant was, "God, you do it my way," because I thought I knew the right way. But I grew up and finished high school, went off to college, and at that point I had never drank or tried it myself or smoked or all these things I thought people did that were bad. But then I got to college, and, of course, I tried it all. And, you know, I'm grateful today. Alcohol didn't do for me what I've heard alcoholics say it does for them. Because if it did, I'm sure that I would not be standing here as an Al-Anon today. What it did for me was I felt like I was in control of everything and that I had to tend to everybody. And when I started feeling it, I felt like I was losing control. I've heard alcoholics say that they felt like it made them more in control, but it didn't do that for me. And I felt like I was losing control. And so what I would do was just drink a little bit and quit, because I had to see about all these other people. And I'm grateful today that I could do that. Anyway, I go on and get through and start working, want to be independent. I'm the most dependent, independent person you've ever met. But I had to get out and be independent and go to work and make a living and have it all together. Well, I At this point, I had not started dating my alcoholic, but it wasn't long after I went to work that I got introduced to this guy. And he drank, but like I said, by then it was okay. You know, I tried it, and I was around drinking. But he didn't drink like these other people. he drank a little bit more than all these other people. And we started dating. Now, my idea of the way things are supposed to be was I start dating this guy. He's my knight in shining armor, you know, and he comes riding up on his white steed, and he sweeps me off my feet. And he gets down on his knees and he proposes. We get married. We get a little white house with a picket fence and two children and live happily ever after. Well, when we started dating, we dated and we dated and we dated. We dated for 7 years. Well, he didn't get down on his knees and propose. I waited and waited and waited. So finally, after 7 years, I decided. I got a little problem with ego, too. I decided that it was time we got married. So I told him it was time to get married. He said, okay. So we got married. Now, by this time, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I knew that he had a problem because he had already lost his license for a year, and he had a problem with drinking, and it was a problem to me. But you see, he loved me so much, I thought, that when we got married, he quit drinking. I didn't realize how powerful alcoholism is and that wouldn't work. But anyway, so we get married, and here we go now. We're going to have our little white house, a picket fence, and our two children live happily ever after. Well, I know now by the time we married, he was a full-blown alcoholic. And so we got on what I like to call the merry-go-round. As soon as we married, it was just his disease had progressed to the point that I decided that I had to do everything I could to make him stop drinking. And the more I tried to make him stop drinking, the more he drank. The more he drank, the more I tried to make him stop drinking. So we got on the merry-go-round. It was going faster and faster as our disease progressed. Because, see, alcoholism is a family illness. I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea I was being affected whatsoever. But I know today that it is a family illness, and I was getting sicker and sicker also. I would do things like pour out his liquor. Then I'd go buy him some more. Because he always had DUIs, and I didn't want him driving because I was afraid he was going to get another DUI, so I'd go get it for him to keep him from getting on the road. One time I decided to dilute it. I thought if I poured out the liquor and put a little water in there, he wouldn't get as drunk. And, you know, I thought at that time that it was okay for him to drink beer because he didn't get as drunk on beer. What I didn't know was he'd keep the beer in the refrigerator, and I'd see him drinking that. But he was hiding his liquor. He was drinking liquor, too, but I thought he was just drinking beer, and I couldn't understand why he could drink so much drink so little beer and get so drunk. But I know today that he was drinking more than that. But I just started doing all these things. When he didn't come home, I'd go looking for him. All the things that people that live with an alcoholic do, most people that I've ever heard speak. So we're getting sicker and sicker, like I said. We've been married about a year and a half. And he had a sister that was in the hospital in another town. She had a two-year-old son, and I kept her two-year-old son a good bit. So there was one day I got off work, and I decided it was time for us to go see his sister in this other town. So I had the two-year-old and my husband, and so we were going to go on a Saturday and visit his sister. Well, my husband hunted and fished, and he had a lot of guns around and all this stuff. And if we ever went anywhere, he had an ice chest full of beer, and he always took his ice chest full of beer. So we load up, and, of course, I drove. I used to say that I drove because he didn't have any license, and then I had to get honest in this program. I would have driven whether he had license or not because, see, I could do it better than he could. That was my attitude. I could do anything. I was more in control, I thought. So we get in the car, I have the two-year-old up front, my husband's in the back, and he's drinking his beer, but he's okay that morning, and we drive, and he took those guns and cleaned them and reloaded them, and he drank his beer, and we got to the place, and we went in to visit his sister. Well, he got away from me. You see, I was into this playing games, let's keep the keys away from the alcoholic by this time, but I was trying to tend to the two-year-old and visit his sister, and so he got away from me. And he left, took the car keys, and he left. But he did come back, and it got time to leave. So we had not eaten, so I decided I had to feed me and to feed the little two-year-old. Well, my husband seemed to be very upset when he got back from his little trip. And he was crying. I thought he was just upset about his sister, you know, and everything's going to be okay. But he said, I don't want to go in and eat. I'm just going to sit in the car and leave the keys. It was hot or whatever. So I took the two-year-old and we went in a fast food place and you could see out the windows. And we're sitting there and I see the car leaving. So I just leave the two-year-old sitting there and I run. He had not pulled out into the traffic. So I ran out and somehow got the car turned off, got him out of the front seat in the back, went back and got the two-year-old and came back and got in the car and headed home. Well, we were in a big city and I was trying to drive and the car had bucket seats. And I kept reaching back trying to tell him everything would be okay. See, I'd never seen him quite like this. I'd seen him drunk a lot. But I'd never seen quite like this. It was as if he didn't know who I was or where he was or what was going on. So I thought if he knew what was going on and who I was, that everything would be okay. But anyway, he grabbed my arm. I finally got it back, and we headed on out. And I'm talking to him, trying to get everything okay. And he sees a liquor store, and he says, pull over at that liquor store. And I said, no, we can't. I've got to get this two-year-old home. And he pulled a loaded gun on me. And he said, I said, pull over. So I pulled over on the side of the road. Now, I had had fears, of course. Everybody has some fears. But I had never had a situation like that in my life. I had never had that kind of fear. And I was so scared. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I was talking for my life, and I was praying, and I was saying, what can I do, God? And I thought, oh, my God, this child seeing this. And I'm responsible for his life, too. All of this was going on, and I didn't know what was going to happen, but about that time, some friends of ours who had been to see his sister and knew our car were leaving also, and they saw the car and thought we had broken down, and they stopped. And, of course, when they stopped, he threw the gun down. And so at that point, I was very relieved, and the woman, this couple was a husband and wife, the woman knew about his drinking problem. She worked with his sister. And so she said, let me take the child and my husband will ride with you. Well, I didn't know her husband very well, and I didn't know what he knew. And he gets in the car in the front, and we're going along, and I thought, I need to tell this man what's going on. He may get shot too, you know. But I didn't know what to do. My husband, of course, was awake, listen. But anyway, we do get home from that. And what I want to talk about for a minute is the fear. I have never felt fear like that in my life. Now, usually I'm the kind of person that talks. I don't stuff feelings, but that's one thing that when that happened, I stuffed it down inside and I couldn't tell anybody. You see, I was 28 years old before we married, and all my friends were married, having babies, and divorce just wasn't an option, and getting out of that marriage wasn't an option. The next morning when he woke up, well, when we got home that night, I got the two-year-old to sleep, I got him to sleep, and I laid awake all night. And then the next morning, I told him in detail everything that he had done. I do believe today that he had no idea. I believe he was in a blackout, and he didn't remember any of it. And he promised me he would never drink again. And I believe he meant it at that time. But he didn't know how not to drink. So in a few days, he was drinking again. But that fear was there, and I had pushed it down inside, and I couldn't tell anybody. And it was a long time before I told anybody. There was a minister that I would go talk to, and I finally was able to tell him. And see, in my thinking, though, divorce just wasn't an option at that point. And I had chosen him. He was mine. And I had to fix this situation. And I really had to fix it now because I was scared for my life. So what did I do? I just redoubled my efforts. Now I'm going to really make him stop drinking. And, of course, the more I did, the more he drank. And so it just got faster and faster, that merry-go-round's going. From that time on, well, in 1977, he was beginning to get in trouble with his drinking to the point that his family owned the business, and he was passed out at the business, and customers were seeing him, and they also owned the farm, so I talked his daddy and moved him out of the business onto the farm where people couldn't see him. But he was really getting in bad shape, and this minister that I could talk to knew a little bit about alcoholism and treatment. So we talked about it, and he said, I know a place, you know, let's see if we can get him to go. So in 1977, he went to his first treatment center. Now, I thought he'd gone for the cure. You know, he's gone treatment, boy, I can breathe a sigh of relief. And then, you know, when he comes home, everything's going to be wonderful. We're going to have those two children, that little white house, and we're going to live happily ever after. Well, I want to tell you this. I was actually 12-stepped while he was in treatment. I used to say these Al-Anons heard about him, and they called me, but I know today they knew about me. And they called, they came to my house, they brought literature, they told me about themselves, and they invited me to a meeting. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in 1977. I thought it was wonderful. Now, he's gone for the cure. I've gone to the Al-Anon meeting, and it was a speaker, and she was really funny. And it was, oh, it was wonderful. And I got this literature. You see, I had a name for him. I always thought he was just a sorry drunk. I thought alcoholic sounded better. So I had a label. So that sounded good to me. I could call him an alcoholic. Well, anyway, it got time. I only went to that one meeting. It got time to go get him from the treatment center. And so I do, and he's young, and he cleans up good, and oh, second honeymoon time. It was wonderful. I go for the few days, go to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting while we're at the treatment center, and I just loved it. I loved alcoholics. So everything's going to be wonderful. We get home, he gets drunk that night. And my world was shot. And I thought, okay, now I really got to make him stop drinking. Well, you know, one of the first things I heard when I got in Al-Anon were the three C's. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. You see, I thought I was the cause of it because through all those years, he kept telling me it was my fault. And after a while, I began to believe it. I thought if I could be prettier, if I could do this, or if I could do that, you know, whatever it was, I'd try it. Sometimes I'd be mean and screaming and hollering and all of this, and sometimes I'd be so sweet, but it didn't matter what I did. It didn't stop the drinking. But I had to learn that I didn't cause it. I didn't make him drink. Now, I contributed to a lot of the chaos that went on. I can tell you that. But I didn't cause him to drink. And I really thought I could control it. For many, many years, I thought I could control it. But I've learned since I came to Al-Anon that I cannot control it. That it's more powerful than me. And see, I thought he'd gone for the cure. And I learned that there was no cure. It can be arrested. It can be treated. But once you're an alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic. But I didn't know these things, so anyway, he comes home and he drinks, and we're going along getting sicker and sicker. I had no clue that I was getting sick. I knew he was. Well, a little while after that, I decided that he had all these problems, and he needed a psychiatrist. So I would take off work. He didn't work. Well, he worked sometimes on the farm, and sometimes he didn't. Daddy never fired him because, you know, he worked for Daddy on the farm. So if he was able to work a little bit, he worked. If he wasn't. So I made the living, in short. And I worked for a living. I had the insurance and all that. So I decided he needed to go to a psychiatrist. It was on an outpatient basis, so I had to take off work. He never had license. I had to drive him to this other town to this psychiatrist. My insurance was paying for it. And then drive him back once a week. So I went in and I told the psychiatrist everything that was wrong with him before he started these sessions. Now, he'd drink on the way up there. He'd go in and talk to the psychiatrist, and I'd wait, and he'd drink on the way home. And this went on week after week after week, and finally I thought, okay, I've got to talk to that psychiatrist again. He just does not understand. So I wanted to go in there to see him, so I finally got him to agree, and I went in to see the psychiatrist one of the trips up there. Do you know what? My husband had convinced the psychiatrist that I was the one with a problem. What little did I know? I did have a problem, but I didn't know it at the time. It made me so mad, I decided he'll never go back to that psychiatrist, and he didn't. So we're going along, like I said, and we're getting so sick. And one time I decided to put him in a 7-day psychiatric unit. He needed that too, I thought. So they locked him up for 7 days. When he got out those 7 days, he looked at me and he said, if you ever put me anywhere else, I'll kill you. That fear that I had stuffed down in here came back. So I thought, okay, I'll never put him anywhere else. I just have to live with him like this the rest of my life. I heard somebody say in Al-Anon, when I first got here, that they related to being the three M's, mother, manager, and martyr. Boy, could I relate to that. We never had those children, so he acted like a child. I treated him like one. And manager, you know I'm in control of everything. I can do it. And martyr, oh, I just was such a good martyr. You know, I'm not proud of that today, but that's the way I was. But anyway, he was not a violent person. Oh, he called me names and all that kind of stuff. Once in a while, he'd put his fist through the wall, pull the phone off the wall. I was the violent one. I was the one. I hit him. I'm not proud of that today. Not all the time, but there was times I was so frustrated. I would break mirrors. I had so much anger inside, and I didn't know what to do with it. And he wasn't the only one calling names either. But this was going on. So we're just, like I said, we're getting sicker and sicker. So when finally in 1984, now let me tell you this, from 1977 to 1984, I never thought about Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon as being a solution to our problem. The reason I didn't, because I was still in control. The seed had been planted, but I didn't need it. I could do it. But in 1984, his parents came to me. They said, we need to get him some help. And I said, I'm not putting him anywhere. And I remembered all that, what he had said. And they said, would you agree to talk to him with us? And I said, yes. So we had one of those little meetings. I know you alcoholics that are sitting in here loved if you ever had one of those where they gang up on you and come in and do this little meeting. But we all talked to him. But see, we all still thought he had a psychiatric problem, that that's all it was. So we decided to put him, take him to a psychiatric unit. But what we did, we talked to him, and he agreed to go talk to the psychiatrist. Well, it was night. And we had it arranged for him to go the next day. Of course, we were going to take his suitcase because we knew he was going to stay. But he had agreed to go. Well, he did what he was supposed to do. He's an alcoholic. That night, when his parents left, he drank. He left and he went and drank. He knew he was fixing to go off. Well, I had gotten to the point that I couldn't feel things. See, it hurt too badly. So what I would do is build these walls up so that I couldn't feel. And when I build these walls up, I also couldn't laugh. I couldn't cry. I couldn't feel. And I hadn't cried in a long time. And I got to sitting there thinking, while he was gone drinking, that I had to take him by myself the next day. And it happened to be the same town that we had been to see his sister at the hospital in. And I thought, I can't do this. And all of a sudden the floodgates opened and I just started crying and I thought, I cannot do this. So I called that minister that had helped us back in 77. And he said, I can't go, I've got a funeral. He said, but you get his parents to go with you. Don't take him by yourself, because he knew about the guns. Anyway, to make this long story short, his mother ended up going with me. Of course, he didn't drink, because mother went, didn't take his beer. We got there, I told the psychiatrist all of his mental problems, everything that was wrong with him, and left him there for them to fix. A few days later, they called me, and they said, we're going to move him out of the psychiatric unit into a unit of this hospital that's for alcohol and drugs. It made me mad as fire. Didn't they know I knew what was best? I'm so grateful today they knew what was best. But anyway, they always thought if you could get all his problems solved, all these things that were wrong with him, then he could quit drinking. What I've learned is, in the first place, I can't solve his problems at all. And he can't either until he gets sober. He can't even work on his problems. But I didn't know that at the time. But anyway, they moved him to the alcohol and drug unit. Then his counselor called me and said, are you willing to tell him that if he doesn't get some help for his drinking, that when he gets home you won't be there? And by this time, I knew that I couldn't live like that any longer. So I told him that. So it gets time to go get him. I go for a couple of days. I didn't take anybody with me. And I had no illusions either that he was going to come home and we were going to live happily ever after either. But I went to the treatment center, went through a couple of days with him, and we came home and he called an AA contact. Now, he had one in 77. He just didn't call him. But he called us AA and he met us and took us to our first meeting in June of 1984. Now, the first few meetings were open AA meetings. There was, and I knew about Al-Anon, but there was no alumni. We were in a little town, and you had to go to two or three different towns to get meetings back then. But anyway, so first few meetings we went to, when he got home, well, I call it anonymous meetings. And I'd sit next to him, and they'd say something I thought he ought to hear, I'd punch him. I want to make sure he heard what he... Now, I couldn't get him sober, but by God, I was going to keep him sober. I wasn't sick. So we go into these meetings, and then see when we get in the car going home at night, after the meeting, I'd have to tell him all that I was afraid he didn't hear, all the good points. One night I was sitting there before a meeting drinking coffee, my husband and I, and this woman came up to me, and she kind of had a gruff voice, and she said, I believe you need to be in this other room. And I was very indignant. You know, I said, I know about Al-Anon. So I went into my first meeting in June of 84. Well, I call that my first. I did go to 177. I went in that meeting, and that woman sold me in a One Day at a Time book, one of our daily readers, and she opened it up to the back, and there's an index, and in there it talks about controlling. She said, I think you need to read these pages. Now, that woman had just met me. But anyway, I wasn't offended. I didn't know I had a problem with control. I didn't know that about me. So I did what she said. I got my book, I went home, and I just read everything I could get. I read, just soaked it up, bought more literature, was just reading it all. Still going, 90 meetings in 90 days, here we go, you know. Well, my husband didn't make 90 meetings in 90 days. One day he came in, and I knew he'd been drinking. Now, I didn't want to do what I had done in the past, and that was the difference. I had only been in Al-Anon a short time, but that was the difference that had made to that point. I didn't want to do what I'd always done. So what I did, I just went back to the bedroom, got my One Day at a Time book, looked in the back, and it talks about slips, the alcoholic slips and Al-Anon slips. And I read those pages right quick. And I went back in there. He was trying to hide it, but I could look at him and tell he'd been drinking. And instead of jumping down his throat and telling him what I thought, what I would have done in the past, yelling, screaming, whatever, this time I looked at him and I said, I know you've been drinking. But you know, that's your choice, and I can't do anything about it. And that was one of the best things I have ever done for me. So he continued to drink, and I continued to go to meetings. He would go sometimes. But I continued to go to Al-Anon and open AA meetings. And at this time, like I said, he wasn't... the gun started coming back into play. He never held another loaded gun on me. He would sometimes when he was drinking. He had a .357 Magnum. Sometimes he would hold it to his head. Because back before Al-Anon, I'd threatened to leave. I didn't know you wasn't supposed to do that until I got this program. Because they told me when I got here, you need to say what you mean what you say, and they had to add, and Linda, you don't have to say it mean. But anyway, that I didn't realize, that I didn't know what was going on, and I would threaten to leave. So he'd hold that .357 Magnum to his head, and he says, if you leave, I'll blow my brains out. Well, I was scared he would, so then I started begging him not to do it, because I figured if he did, it'd be my fault. And I couldn't live with that. I didn't really care at that point whether he lived or died. I'd gotten to that point, but I didn't want the responsibility of him killing himself. Well, then what he would do is he'd go out of the house and he'd shoot the gun. And I'd go running out there. I just knew he'd killed himself. This didn't happen just once. This happened over and over till I got to the point one day that I didn't beg him not to. And he went out and shot the gun, and I thought, God, I wish he would kill himself. See, I thought he was my problem. And if he was gone, I'd be okay. Little did I know how sick I was. Anyway, this was some of the stuff that went on. Well, he's drinking again. The guns are there. I'm scared. And I'd heard when I got in the program, I kept going to meetings, got a sponsor, started working on Linda. They kept telling me over and over, take the focus off the alcoholic and put it on yourself. And I'm so grateful they did that. Because, see, I was so focused on him and had been. We dated 7 years, and by then we'd been married about 10 years, that's all I could see. I had completely given my life over to him and trying to fix him. So I could not see anything else. And so as they said that, and as I read the literature, and as I went to meetings, gradually I began to put the focus on me And I began to get better. And I'm so grateful for that today. There's something in our reading that says that you can get better regardless of whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And that is true, and I'm so grateful. So I keep going to meetings, I'm working on me, and I'm living with him, and I'm getting scared again. And I didn't want to make the they told me not to make a major decision in the first year. But I knew that I couldn't live there anymore, I was too scared. So about 6 months into the program, I, at that point, had no intentions of divorce, but I just could not live there. We lived on the family farm, and had no children, had very little possessions, so I packed my little bag and I left, and I moved. Well, when I moved, I was scared again, so I did not tell him where I was going. I told him I was going, but I didn't tell him where I was moving to. My sponsor told me that this had happened to her, and that they had told her not to, whatever she told them, that she had to be willing to stick to it, that say what you mean what you say. And so I knew that I meant that, so I told him when I left. I mean, when I finally told him where I was after I left, I told him, if you're drinking, don't come. If you come here, I'll call the law. And he believed me. My pride was hurt. He never came to see me. Because he was drinking, and he knew I meant it. Now, he would call, and I wasn't well yet either. I went and got him and took him to a few meetings still during that time. Once in a while, went and checked on him once. But I was slowly letting go. But anyway, he would call, and sometimes he would be crying and begging me to come back, telling me he loved me. Sometimes he would be drunk, and he'd be cussing me and all of that kind of stuff. I learned to hang up the phone. That was one of the good things I learned, too. I didn't have to listen to it when it was like that. I didn't have to argue. I didn't have to get into all that. But anyway, so after 9 months, and he still had not... He would come see me when I was at work. He knew my schedule. He'd leave flowers and cards, but he never came when I was there. But after 9 months, I was doing an awful lot of praying, asking God what to do. And see, I'd finally gotten to the point that I really meant it when I prayed, "Thy will be done." I was down on my knees. I was working on me. It was 9 months separation there. And I was really working on me, and I was trying to decide what to do, and I was asking God to guide me. Show me what to do with our marriage, with my life. I didn't want to do the same things I'd always done. So I was praying about this, and I had to get okay. I didn't believe in divorce, so I had to get okay with God before I could go ahead with a divorce. And I had to get honest again and say, you know, when you sit in these rooms with these alcoholics, whoo, there was a good-looking one sitting over there. And I didn't believe it was right, and he was after me. And I didn't believe it was right. I didn't believe it was right to date as long as I was just separated. So I finally got to the point that I got the divorce so that I could date this guy. But God did for me what I could not do for myself. The guy chased me until I got a divorce, and then I started chasing him. He didn't want me anymore. And I do believe God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. One time I was talking to my sponsor. Oh, when I left my husband, I moved to a different group. That woman, a few things wrong with him, and, you know, needed changing. And I was telling him, I was just talking about this. She said, "Linda, what are you going to do, change him?" Well, now, I've been in the program long enough to know I couldn't change anybody. So I said, "No, ma'am, I just think I'll be a good influence on him." She said, "You better look at that." But anyway, I was sick, but I was getting better. And I left him alone finally because he didn't want me. But I did go ahead and divorce. And I'm living by myself, working, going to meetings. That was my life. And I was going every night, open AA or Al-Anon meetings. And like I said, now my first sponsor, when I first got in, loved me back to living. You've never been hugged until you had been hugged by her. I didn't feel love. I couldn't feel anything, remember, much of anything when I got here. But she would hug you so that you just felt love. And so I say she loved me back to living. But the second one that I was talking about, she loved me unconditionally, but she didn't let me get away with anything, which I'm grateful for today. So I'm very slowly recovering. I'm going to meetings on a regular basis. I'm doing a four-step, and I did that. And did you know what happened? When I did a four-step, I realized what a controlling person I was. And when I did my fifth step with my sponsor, I said, oh, I'm terrible. This is awful. I didn't know this. She said, Linda, you did the best you could with what you had, but you know better now. I couldn't get away with still trying to do the things that I used to do, and I'm grateful for that. I didn't want to be that way. Now, it doesn't mean I'm not a controlling person anymore, because I still will like to control things sometimes, but I don't do like I used to do, and I'm grateful for that. After my divorce, this sponsor and her husband took me to a lot of AA conventions and some Al-Anon weekends and Al-Anon conventions, got me started in service work. I became the GR of the group, and we were at one of these weekends like this, a roundup, and they introduced me to this man in AA, a friend of theirs from another town. Well, I still kind of liked that young guy that was so cute, but this guy just became a friend. And we'd see each other at assemblies, we'd see each other at conventions, and he'd take me to dinner. And just for about a year, he'd call every once in a while. We just were friends. He was older, he was nice looking, but he was older, and he just wasn't what I wanted, I didn't think, at that time. But then again, like I said, God does for you what you can't do for yourself. As we were going to these things, finally he asked me in 1986, I'd known him about a year, he said, can I come see you? Well, now, I had tried dating some earth people, but they were boring. I just love alcoholics. They were so boring. And then I dated a preacher. Now, he wasn't too bad. He kind of compared to alcoholics. He could have been one. But anyway, I don't know about that. But anyway, he asked me if he could come see me. Well, he lived about 70 miles away, and I said, yeah, I didn't have anybody else at the time. So he came to see me, and 6 months later, we were married. He was my best friend, and we started dating, and we dated for a while, and all those things that were negative about him being older, and all the other things that I could find at the time, just seemed not to matter anymore when we got to going together. I know that, see, he was the love of my life. I know that God put us together. It was a special, special time. But anyway, so we get married, and I moved to his town, which is 70 miles away, in Waycross, that's where I'm from today. Now, here we go. I'm in Al-Anon. He's got 3 years sobriety, and I've got 2 years in Al-Anon. And we're both in service work, and we're doing all this stuff, you know, and things are good. Now, I would have told you that my fantasy was gone. I'm in this program. I'm into acceptance. You know, I'm not living in a fantasy world anymore. I'm into reality. I mean, I know life's not always that you're going to get this knight in shining armor and the little white house and the two children and all of this and live happily ever after. And I would have told you I knew that. But when we got married, my fantasy wasn't dead. He was older, so he had children in their 20s. But I had never had those children. And I was 40 years old. But we discussed it before we married because I had always wanted children. And so we decided to just leave it in God's hands. I got pregnant on the honeymoon. But I didn't even know I was. I lost that child at 6 weeks. But I thought, okay, so I can. Maybe I can. So I worked real hard for 2 years, and it was a lot of fun. And then when I was 42, I got pregnant again. And I carried that baby 3 months, and I lost that child. Now, I was devastated. But see, I know that it was the loss of the child. But it was also the loss of the dream, because Rip didn't want me to try again. That was my husband's nickname, Rip. He didn't want me to try again. And so I knew that I couldn't have those children, the little white house with the picket fence, go hand in hand to church and be this perfect little family. So my dream had to die too. So I grieved. I grieved the loss of the child, and I grieved the loss of the dream. And what happened to me at that time, and I would have told you by then, I was probably, 5 years in the program, I would have told you that I had a good program, and I had a good conscious contact with God. I was sponsoring an Al Teen group. I was in service work. I was district rep. I was doing all of these things. And Rip and I had a wonderful marriage, and all of a sudden, every bit of it went out the window. I got mad. I was angry. Life was not what I wanted it to be, and I could not accept it. I was moaning and groaning. The only two things I did right, I had a sponsor. I got another sponsor when I moved out of town to the new town. I called my sponsor. I cried and carried on, but I called my sponsor during that time, and I went to meetings. I didn't want to go to meetings, but I went to meetings. I'd sit there, and I'd just be angry with everybody in the meeting. I'd fold my arms like this, you know. I didn't like anybody, but I went, and I called my sponsor. And I'm grateful I did those two things. One night we were lying in bed, and Rip, I was crying, carrying on. Rip said, Linda, you need to look at something. I think you're angry with God. And I thought, me? No. See, all during the alcoholism, that's how I got through it. I didn't have Al-Anon then. I held on to God. I had a relationship with God, even during all that time. It might not have been just like it ought to have been, but I had one. And so I thought, why? Not me. And in the next breath, I thought, God, why did you let me get pregnant if you were going to take my baby? And I realized that I was angry with God. And see, when I was angry with God, I wasn't all right with me. I wasn't all right with you. And I wasn't all right with anything. And you know how I got back from that? I kept going to meetings. And I prayed even when I didn't feel like it, didn't want to. I heard somebody say that what they did was they prayed every morning before they got out of bed. And so I started trying to do that. And I started praying the way this program taught us to pray, only for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. Because they said when their feet touched the floor, their mouth came open, and I identified. And I thought, that's what I'm going to do. So I have done that ever since that time, and I still do that today. I pray. It's automatic now when I wake up in the morning before I get out of bed. That's what's on my mind, and I pray. And I'm so grateful for that. So we're going along. I finally get better. I get back my conscious contact with God. Rip spoke at these kind of conferences, and I started speaking at these, and we were going all over the United States, and I stayed involved. He got out of service work. He started a halfway house for alcoholics. I got involved to the point that I was alternate delegate. I am the delegate for Georgia at this point. But anyway, I was into all of this, you know. Everything's good. We're happy. I finally had, you know, sometimes I have to get things from my head to my heart. And I had to get the acceptance of that dream dying and acceptance of reality from here to here. And it just took some time to do that. With God's help, I got it. I finally got it. And I was okay. And you know how good God is. After I lost that baby, He gave me a granddaughter. She's 8 today. But Rip's son and his wife had a little girl, and I got to be grandma. So God is good. So we're going along. Like I said, everything's good. The children, his children, the grandchildren, and all of this stuff we're doing, and I'm so happy. Well, in 1995, my world fell apart. My husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I thought, no, I can't do this, God. I just can't go through this. But you know how I handled this? I said, God, help me. I called out to God, and I said, God, help me get through this. And see, I had always been the kind that I thought I had to put on that false face, that front, and I had to keep it all together. So during his illness, I was the one that was trying to be the cheerleader and get everything okay. But I didn't handle his death as well as he did. We're going along, and he has cancer. And they found it in his bones, but it was all over his body, in his liver and his lungs and everywhere. It had metastasized. And we're going for mostly pain management. They did some treatments on him. And we're going to these, and I want to get in there and ask those doctors all these questions, but thank God for Al-Anon. I went with him, but I stood back and let him, because I wanted to know how long, and that wasn't my place to ask, and I'm grateful I didn't. We were in the doctor's office one day, and he asked how long he had, and they said 6 months. But during that time, he just had the best attitude. He had a program you wouldn't believe. He had been sober 12 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous. People would come by and say, I don't understand. Why you? You're doing so much, helping so many alcoholics. He'd say, why not me? Why am I any different? And I'd say, oh, we got to pray for a miracle. You've already had one miracle done. You're sober. He'd just sit back and he said, Linda, just pray for God's will. It'll be okay. Just pray for God's will. You see, I didn't want God's will done. Here I am back to that again. I didn't want God's will. I was afraid he was going to die. They said he was going to die. And I didn't want that to happen. So I was having a hard time praying for God's will. I was asking for God's help, but I was having a hard time getting it from here to here again. But as time went on and he was getting weaker and weaker, I finally got to the point about a month before he died that I had a little talk with God, and I finally accepted. I knew he would be better off. He was suffering so, and I loved him more than anything in this world, and I didn't want him suffering anymore. And so I could finally accept what was going to be. Well, it came the time, he wanted to die at home. So he wasn't hospitalized. He was going, as a matter of fact, all the time up until the last 5 days. Now, he was weak, but he could go places. The last 5 days, he was in the bed. And the morning that he died, I was with him and his daughter and a hospice nurse. And I was on the bed with him, and I was holding him in my arms. Now, hospice had told us how it could be. Some deaths with cancer can be very bad, gasping for breath and this kind of thing. But I know something. I know that God was in that room that morning. I felt the presence of God. I was holding him in my arms, and he took a breath. Then he took another breath, and then he was just gone. And it was a peaceful going. And I know God just came and got him and took him home. When I had held up, because I felt I had to hold up through all of this. But then when he died in my arms, I fell apart. Now, during the 6 months of his illness, our house was a constant flow of AA and Al-Anons in and out. And how they got there so fast that morning, of course, everybody knew he was dying. I don't know. But the house filled up with people. Well, I had to pull it together again because I had to get through the funeral. But everybody was there. My family, my Al-Anon and AA family also, for me. I got through the funeral. And then Connie, that rode up here with me from Georgia, one of my best friends, stayed, and one of my sisters stayed overnight. But after the funeral was over and everybody was gone and they left, I thought, God, I can't do this. It just hurts too much. I cannot do this. I wanted to die. I loved him more than anything in this world, and I just wanted to die. But I couldn't kill myself. I never have been a person who could kill myself. See, there were times when I was living in alcoholism, I wanted to die. But I couldn't kill myself. But I just wanted to die. Well, this friend of mine from Memphis, Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, sent me a poem. And she personalized it like it was a letter from heaven from him. And it's saying, you know, how bright and beautiful it was in heaven. He said, Dear Linda, you know, it's bright and beautiful in heaven, and how God was with us through all of the pain and the suffering, and that it was going to be wonderful when it was, you know, when I came, and how much he deeply loved me. But there was a line that stood out to me, and it said, But your work is not done yet. And for some reason that stood out to me, because you see, I didn't know why I couldn't go on. I didn't want to live. But I knew that my God knows what's best. And there was something still for me to do. Now, I wanted to pull the covers over my head and never get out of the house. But I had to work, support myself. So I had to get out and go to work, and I didn't quit going to meetings. I kept going to meetings. You know, this time, I got angry with God before, but this time, I didn't have to go there. I didn't get angry with God. It drew me closer to God. And I held on to God, and I said, God, show me what you want me to do. And I would just put one foot in front of the other. I didn't know what to do, but I just put one foot in front of the other and kept doing what I was doing. My work is helping alcoholics and family members of alcoholics, so I still get to do it there. I sponsor people. I was going to a lot of meetings, and I kept hearing, God's will won't lead you where His grace can't sustain you. And you know that's so true. God held me up. You ever heard of the footprints in the sand? Sometimes there's only one set of footprints, but that's because God's carrying you. Well, God carried me through that when I couldn't go. I was speaking one time, and I said, you know, I believe God set me down. There's two sets of footprints. I wish He'd pick me back up. And I realized that's exactly what God does. He carries me when I can't go. And then He puts me down to hold His hand and walk by His side. But if it gets too rough again, He'll pick me back up and carry me. And that's what He's done. And I don't always know what God wants me to do. But I know I just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And He'll show me and asking for His will to be done. A year after my husband died, I was diagnosed with cancer. I thought, oh, okay. I'm ready, God, take me on home. I never thought I'd react to cancer that way. But at that point, I was grieving, and at that point, it was okay. My next thought was, oh, but God, I don't want to suffer like He did, or my mother, or other people that I knew that died with cancer. But I had breast cancer, and God is so good, and I was so fortunate. It was caught early, and I had my breast removed, and it had not spread. I didn't have to have chemotherapy, radiation, or anything. I had reconstructive surgery. And so I said, okay, God, what else you want me to do? You must not be through with me yet. So I just kept doing what I was doing. I've got to tell you this, and then I'll close. That first husband that I divorced, he never got sober. He lived in my hometown near my family there. So I heard, and I stayed in touch with his sister and his mother through the years. And I knew that he would try AA. He had tried to stay sober, but that he had never had any amount of sobriety, that he couldn't stay sober. 2 years after my love of my life, Rip, died, I got a phone call from his sister saying that my first husband had been found dead at his house. He died from alcoholism. He was a good person. You know, I didn't hate that man. I just could not live in active alcoholism. He had never remarried, so it came time to go to the funeral, and they wanted me to come, and I went to the funeral. And, you know, what a waste. You know, it's a miracle. All of us, not just the alcoholics, Al-Anons too, it's a miracle that we're in these rooms. There's so many that don't make it. He was a wonderful person. He was one of those that just couldn't get it. But anyway, I went to the funeral, and his mom wanted to know if I wanted to go by his house, and I did, and with them, and get some things, because when I left everything. We didn't have much, but I went, and I had the opportunity to make amends to his family. Because, you see, not only did I tell him what to do, but I told them what they should do, too, all those years. And his mother was grieving so and blaming herself. I should have done things differently. I had the opportunity to tell her, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. Didn't matter what we did, we couldn't make him stop drinking. Another thing, though, this is how I can revert back so easily. I got there to that house, and I'd not been around a drinking alcoholic in a long time, how they lived and that messy house and everything. And I thought, you know, I should have done something. Rip and I should have done something. We should have tried to help him all those years. And I just forgot I was powerless. And I'm glad I had the opportunity to go back and realize once again that how powerless I am over alcohol. I couldn't fix him then, and I couldn't fix him at that time. I never had a chance to make direct amends to that man. He sent me some letters after Rip died. He wanted me back still. Of course, he was still drinking. I didn't respond. But I never had made direct amends, so when I went to his funeral, I had the opportunity to go to his casket and make direct amends to him for me. And I'm grateful for that opportunity too. But God has been good to me. All of this, I can be okay. It's been over four and a half years since Rip died. He died in January 96. And I don't know sometimes what I'm doing anymore. I just know that I have to keep going and doing the best I can. So I want to close with a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. It says, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. I strive to do this today. I strive to stay spiritually fit. I don't stay there all the time. But it says, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Thank you.